This is History in D&D. Last time, I covered the beginnings of Dungeons & Dragons, and TSR, that's Tactical Study Rules founder, Gary Gygax being ousted by Lorraine Williams. I also covered my friends and I playing Dungeons & Dragons in grade 7 for the first time, and going on into the 90s, and I covered some campaign settings up until 1994 and some other major products. Following the ousting of Gary Gygax, Lorraine took over, and the company began to find some level footing. Lorraine was more of a businesswoman. The Blooms and Gygax had personal eccentricities that had led to financial problems, making personal purchases. But Lorraine's main drawback was that she just didn't understand her customers. And this probably led to her ignoring what creatives were doing. Normally, companies have a department with a lot of power, and it's almost never the creative department. Except in startups, but that's more of an entrepreneurial thing. In established companies, it tends to be sales, marketing, HR, manufacturing, etc. And they tend to hold the creatives back. But with Lorraine not understanding their customers and actually disdaining gamers, thinking herself above them, I don't think she spent that much time with creatives and probably ignored them. I think these departments may have seen creatives as being best left alone or sort of like golden geese. And the reason I think this is because Spelljammer and Planescape are so wacko and out there. I don't see that anyone with upper management potential greenlighting something like that. I want to kind of look at how Dungeons & Dragons was looked at from the outside. Not from the player perspective, and not from the company perspective, but the general populace. And for most of early D&D, it was ignored. The media started to pay attention to it during the Satanic Panic, but ignored it again thereafter. I think they probably went on to video games and video game shooters, TV, and lately it's screen time. But they've largely ignored Dungeons & Dragons. And in fact, something that I'd want to look at is in modern times now, the exact opposite is true. Parents are quite happy that any of their kids want to sit down, read a book, sit around a table with a bunch of friends, and imagine things. We're in a weird world. So, with the media either ignoring Dungeons & Dragons or promoting the Satanic Panic around Dungeons & Dragons, this meant if someone heard of the game, they probably heard that it was evil. And it was exacerbated by people who didn't play the game explaining to the media how the game worked. And often they would focus on the perceived negative aspects, not understanding the general heroics of the game. So there was a universally skewed opinion. In addition to that, it's hard to explain the game to a non-initiate. And starting from a negative bias doesn't really help them understand it. And that means the player base was small and relatively static during this time period. But rebellion, outsider status, and introversion were means to entering the hobby. And to some degree, this was how I started playing. I wasn't well-liked at my new school, but I found some friends who also felt at times like they were outsiders, and we used that as a springboard to create adventures. Some might call this a hero with a thousand faces moment. Some. As I said in the previous episode, we made new characters at any level we wanted every time we played, and our DM ran us through mostly random dungeons. Later in high school, we discovered new people to play the game with, and our adventures expanded. But soon we started going to a local convention while more and more gaming stores were opening. And they would join the small number of hobby shops that had already existed and had sold games. This meant We had more access to new and old products from TSR, and we discovered campaign settings, as well as quite a few other materials and new board games. Also discussed last time, campaign settings were baked into the game from the very beginning with Blackmoor and Greyhawk. Soon both were superseded by Forgotten Realms, and our DM, Chad, preferred this setting for a while. Chris and I liked Dragonlance, and he bought the Tolatus box set. Sometime after 1989, I discovered Spelljammer, and it was a campaign setting using the Ptolemaic universe centered around space exploration that connected all the other settings. The world set in the Forgotten Realms and Dragonlance were inside giant crystal spheres floating in the Phlogiston. And I was really into that idea. Unfortunately, almost no one else was. I think this nutso concept was only possible, as I said before, because no one was paying attention to what the creatives were doing. I just get the feeling that the executives thought they were printing money and it didn't matter what was on. So while many in the community were upset that the powers that be were putting out too much dreck and looked down on their customers, it didn't really faze me. I was under no obligation to pay for any of it. And I was glad to see so much stuff being thrown at the wall until something stuck. Of course, at this point, the shelves were full of things no one wanted. So Random House, a distributor for TSR, sent it back. And you know what? No one running the company had planned for that. TSR was about to enter a very dark time. The dark times. But let's go back. First in 1981, TSR signed the Random House deal. Also in that deal, a clause in which payment of 27.3% was made on delivery, but product could be returned. As discussed last time, Gary Gygax brought Lorraine Williams to help him undo financial disaster brought on by the Blooms, but she bought their shares and pushed Gary out. Now, I came across a story that I couldn't immediately validate, although it sounds true enough. The story states that TSR bought an expensive editorial computer system that was cutting edge at the time, but by the 90s was obsolete due to desktop publishing. This meant they weren't able to be as agile or innovative as smaller, newer companies, so they were married to this expensive clunker that was holding them back. Also, TSR ramped up output over the years. By the 90s, they'd begun to experiment with several new games, projects that didn't do as well as they hoped. They also overproduced D&D materials and delayed payments to the printer. In addition to all that, there were a number of newer companies eating up the customer base because those companies were creating innovative products customers actually wanted. Not least of these was Wizards of the Coast, which had created a card game, Magic the Gathering, in 1993. And then to top it all off, out of what seemed a combination of IP protection and spite, TSR was constantly engaging in costly lawsuits with its founder, Gary Gygax. With debt to the printer mounting, they were forced to sign an exclusive deal, and this allowed the printer to raise rates. All this led to a perfect storm in April of 1996, when Random House sued for payment on a $9.5 million loan and returned millions of dollars worth of products. Up until now, TSR was scraping by as long as no more than 20% was returned. Now it had crept up to 30%. The cascade had begun. The stage was set. Despite sales of $40 million, TSR was on the brink. In 1997, the printer stopped producing any new product until TSR paid their previous debt. Five Rings Publishing, the company behind Legend of the Five Rings card game, sent their CEO, Bob Abramowitz, to go to Lake Geneva, and he acquired a letter giving him an option to buy. But his company didn't have the liquidity for that, so he notified Wizards of the Coast CEO, Peter Atkinson, with the intention of having Wizards also buy Five Rings. Peter Atkinson and future Paizo CEO Lisa Stevens flew to Lake Geneva and spent the summer of 1997 managing the company's transition from TSR to Wizards. Peter Atkinson and Wizards went out of their way to accommodate TSR employees and help them move to Seattle. In addition, the company culture was more open and inclusive, and upper management was more approachable. 3 months later, Wizards had turned D&D into a profitable line once again. I was unaware of all this until months later, I imagine my friend Chris told me. He probably saw it in a trade magazine or heard from someone at a game store. From the mid-90s on, I had drifted away from D&D. Chris and I had started playing Magic the Gathering after buying boosters and starters from the revised edition. We'd also been playing more board games and video games. The PlayStation had come out, and N64 was soon to follow. GoldenEye wasn't going to play itself. Also, shortly after getting a driver's license, I bought a shiny used Ford Probe from Sean's stepdad, and then I had to deliver pizza to pay for that. There were parties to attend, underground drag races to observe, nightclubs to go to, and various other social events that had nothing to do with D&D. And in addition, I spent an obscene amount of time just driving around my small town in my first car. You know, doing my part to ruin the environment. So most of this was beyond me, and I wasn't as connected to it anymore. We went from playing D&D nearly every day to once or twice a year when Chad went to college, and finally, by the time I set foot on campus on my first day in college in 1998, D&D really wasn't on my mind anymore. It would become something we reminisced about in the 2000s. And then when we heard Wizards of the Coast would be coming out with a third edition, I think I had a very mute response. And I'll cover that and the restoration of D&D in the next episode. Also, I'll touch on MMOs and specifically how Dungeons & Dragons Online rekindled my fondness for the greatest game. This has been History and D&D. Hadad, and I hope your day is free of thunderbolts.